Hello, everybody. This is lecture 7 on induction. Now, if you remember a couple weeks ago, we mentioned that this lecture was going to be at a later time, but it was shifted back to the original time. I hope people aren't confused by this. I guess maybe the ones who are confused are the ones who you couldn't say necessarily the ones who didn't show up. Maybe some of the people here forgot the time was going to be changing and they came to this time and they turned out to be right even though they had no basis for it. I don't know. But in any event, I'm sorry for the if there was any confusion about the time. And since we're talking about induction, it's good, we're a bit confused about the time because this is an illustration that induction isn't infallible. If people were going on the basis that I said the time was going, last lecture was going to be later, and then they thought, well, when essentially the instruction course says something about the time, you should rely on it. It turns out that induction isn't always true, you see. So there's a general point, as we'll be seeing later in the lecture, that induction isn't always reliable, so maybe we can get some benefit from the confusion, especially if there was any. Now, what we've been doing in the course so far, we've been concentrating on deductive reasoning. How do we get from two true premises to a conclusion that's also true? How do we get new truth given that we have truth already? And to get to that stage, you remember we had to first set it up that we have the three acts of the mind, conception and judgment, because in order to have a reason, in order to have a syllogism where we have the two premises and the conclusion, we have to know what a proposition is, because each premise is a proposition or a judgment. And to know what a judgment is, we have to first know what a concept or idea is, because in the system of logic we're studying, each proposition consists of two concepts that are joined by copula, which is the formula verb to be. So this is should be very familiar ground to us. By now we have the three acts, mind, conception, judgment, and reasoning. And if the key point why we're so interested in this is, again, if we start off with true premises, we can get additional truth. So deduction is a recipe or formula for generating new truth. But there's a problem. Suppose we said, oh, we've got this great mechanism now we want to come up with. We know we can get new truth if we start off with true premises. But before we can start coming up with all the new truth, we have something we haven't settled yet. Is if we want to have new truth, we have to start off with truth. So where do we get the true premises from in the first place? Now, one way we could get it is what we could say, we could take the premise in our syllogism as the conclusion of another syllogism. Because remember, if we start in syllogism, we have true premises coming up with the conclusion. So we could say, well, we just take the premises as the conclusion with another syllogism. But then that would just push back the question further. How do we know that syllogism was true? How do we know the premises of that syllogism, namely the one we're using to get the premise of our new syllogism? How do we know that one's true? And we couldn't push back indefinitely and say each premise is the conclusion of a syllogism, because we'd get caught in an infinite regress. We'd have to come up with some premises that are not conclusions of other syllogisms, so we could start the whole process off. Because otherwise, we won't have any guarantee that our premises are true in the syllogism. So Remember, we're only guaranteed a true conclusion if we're starting off from true premises. So we need to have some non-syllogistic way of coming up with true premises so we can get started. Now, one way we can get a true premise where we don't have to rely on some syllogism is through an analytic judgment. Remember, we discussed analytic judgment in the previous lecture. An analytic judgment, as Joyce characterizes it, is one where either, there are two kinds, either the predicate is part of the subject, or the subject is part of the predicate. So, suppose you take this one, all triangles are three-sided figures. So you see there's a logical connection between triangles and three-sided figures, because if you had various kinds of three-sided figures, triangles would be among them, or they might be identical with three-sided figures. That's the way you define the triangle, the three-sided figure. So, again, an analytic judgment, you don't need to establish it by using an additional premise, because either the subject is part of the predicate or the predicate is part of the subject. And you'll remember, Joyce uses a different notion of analytic judgments from the one that's customary in post-Kantian philosophy, where Kant and Kant was followed by most of the philosophers who came after him. An analytic judgment is just where the predicate is part of the subject. Suppose you say, all bachelors are unmarried men. So they're of a certain age. So unmarried men would be, they're identical with the subject. So really the subject and predicate would be equivalent. But Joyce recognizes the other variation where the subject is just included in the predicate and doesn't include all of the predicate. But that's not really essential if we grasp that distinction. I just mentioned it because it's as I mentioned in an earlier lecture, this extended notion of analytic judgment is kind of a way of getting rid of synthetic a priori judgments, whether it's successful or not is a different question. But just remember, Joyce has this extended view of analytic judgment. So, but you see, in an analytic judgment, regardless of how it's characterized, you don't need any, once you understood the analytic judgment, you don't need any further argument or evidence on why the premise is true. Once you grasp an analytic judgment, then it's true. Now, just as a sideline, in Austrian economics, which many of you, I'm sure, have studied, has developed by Mises, the Austrian economics consists of analytic judgment, at least much of it consists of analytic judgment and deductions from them. For example, every action uses means to achieve ends. How do we know that in Austrian economics? Well, it's not that we look at a lot of different examples of action and we see each one happens to use a means to achieve an end, so we can get a kind of reliable judgment that action uses means to achieve end. No, it's not how we do it. We just see that part of the concept of action that you're using a means to achieve an end. So it's an analytic judgment, at least in this extended sense that Joyce has in mind. Another example is an actor always chooses his most highly valued end. It isn't there that we could say, oh, well, there's an exception to this because, look, there's somebody who just found, maybe he's living in Australia, just like the blacks with the black swans will return the white swan. There was black swan in Australia. But we found that person in Australia who doesn't choose his most highly valued animal. That couldn't happen because it's an analytic judgment that you always choose your most highly valued end. Part of the way most highly valued end is characterized is the one you would choose. So it can't turn out to be false that the actor chooses his most highly valued end. I see there's a question here. Someone says, Joe says, is the primary premise called an axiom in scholastic logic? I think that's correct. I'd have to check the terms to be sure. I believe that's correct, yes. Now, I should say before we get into induction, there are other ways, I didn't put them down on the slide, that we can have premises that aren't, that are other than analytic ones, premises that we don't need further evidence for that we know are true. Well, let's take the statement, I exist. You can imagine each of you saying about yourself, I exist. Well, that wouldn't be analytic. It's not analytic you exist. You might not exist. It's quite the one time you didn't exist. So it's not analytic. But nevertheless, you don't need evidence for it. Once you understand the proposition, you see it's true. So you could have statements, or let's take another case, physical objects exist. You wouldn't need, that couldn't be overthrown, at least it exists at a particular time. That wouldn't need further exploration to see whether it's true. You could just grasp it's true right away. So I think Joyce seems to suggest that the only premise where we don't need induction to establish would be analytic judgment, right? I think we can have others as well. But in most cases, again, if we want to know how do we know the premise that we want to use in syllogism are true, we have to rely on experience. Suppose you had an argument that had one premise that I'm now giving a lecture or you're listening to a lecture by me. So how would you know that's true? Well, it's not something you could just look at the statement and see that it's true. I'm giving a lecture. I might not be giving a lecture. Most times I don't give a lecture, so you have to just look and see whether I was. You have to learn from experience. So suppose we say, I give this example here on the slide, how we know that people need to eat in order to live. Suppose this isn't something we deduce from the concept of human beings or concept eating food. It's just we can do some investigation. We can discover various properties of human beings or of animals, and we see they need to have food in order to survive. They need a source of energy, which they have. So they have, if they don't have this, we have kind of a well-developed theory that they need food in order to survive. And this is something we don't just get just by thinking about it, but we learn it from experience. And most premises, as I say, there are disciplines such as Austrian economics that don't depend on experience, but a great deal of our knowledge does depend on experience, on trying to find out what's going on in the world. Now, when we talk about experience, experience is always about particular events at a particular time. For example, say, you're now experiencing my giving a lecture, but what you're experiencing is a particular lecture at a particular time. You wouldn't say experience just the concept lecturing at a particular time. That wouldn't be something you get an experience, you can form such a concept. But if you're talking about an experience, it's always about a particular event, a particular time. And you'll notice this itself is a conceptual truth about experience. This isn't something you just find out. This is part of a concept of experience that we get it at. It concerns particular events at a particular time. So this raises a problem in that in our inferences, we very often use premises that claim to be universally true, like say the old one we've used many times called, of course, all men are mortal. Well, that's not something we could experience. We could experience the deaths of particular people. Say, my neighbor just died a few days ago, so that would be something we could learn from experience. But we can't learn from experience that all men or all human beings are mortal. So how can we get, the question comes up, how do we get to a universally true proposition if our experience is confined to particulars? Suppose, for example, we found on a number of occasions that water runs downhill. What would justify the generalization that water always runs downhill? Wait, I see someone come. Keith says, I just use all men and mortals analytics in my notes. I don't think it would be analytic. I mean, supposing people just didn't die, I don't think we'd want to say, we just invented some kind of new pill, people aren't going to die anymore. Would that make it the case they were human beings? I don't think that it would. But now if you thought it would, then maybe you would take it to be analytic. But I was suggesting it's not. I mean, you're not clearly wrong about it. Just a matter of how you would interpret the statement. So, sometimes it's very hard to tell if a statement is analytic. It just depends on what you want to build into the concept. Now, so I say, I've set up this problem, well, we have experiences of a particular, but how do we get to need general truth in our premise? So how do we get to the general truth from particular experience? Now, the conclusion I'm going to come up with, what's the answer, it's rather disappointing, is that there's no generally accepted answer to the problem. George Joyce, who's the author of our textbook, has an answer based in the scholastic tradition, but there isn't, this is a very interesting approach that he has, but there isn't an approach that's generally accepted by everybody or by most people who've written on the topic. In deductive logic, there's almost universal agreement on what are the correct ways of inferences. There are differences of opinion on certain points among logicians, but there's standardly accepted views on what's valid inference. But that isn't true for induction. It isn't that people say, well, how do we get what justifies us in making these generalizations from particular experiences? There isn't a commonly accepted solution. Now, Joyce's solution to this problem, how do we get to these generalizations from particular experiences, depends on the fact that the generalizations we make from experience are about causes. And what does it mean by cause? It means the reason for something, that thing. What makes a thing to be what it is. For example, the way Joyce would look at, as you said, water runs downhill. The generalization would have some reference to why water runs downhill. We have an appeal to the law of gravity. You would have some account of what's involved in cause. Joyce's approach, by the way, is similar to the new, so-called new solution of problem induction, which is offered by Leonard Peikoff, the objectivist philosopher, book by David Harriman, who's a follower of his, called The Logical Leap. And I'll just mention that just in passing, that a lot of people, or some people at any rate, are interested in the Ayn Rand movement objectivist philosophy. I gave a course on that last year. But what Peikoff thinks is the objectivists have a particular view of how we acquire concepts from experience, and they think that causal laws are just generalizations from concepts. So they think, well, if we're forming the concepts correctly and generalize from them properly, then your generalization is justified. But I'm not sure, I don't think they really show that that's the case, but I just mention them here because their approach does have some, quite a few similarities with the older scholastic view that Joyce has, but they think it's a new approach, but it isn't all that new, or at least something analogous to their solution isn't all that new. So to spell out what Joyce has in mind, he thinks sometimes we can recognize the causal relationship immediately. For example, I grasp immediately, I can just see right away that I caused the previous slide to shift to this one. Let me just shift it back. You see, I just press this button on the mouse and the slide shifted back, and I shifted it again, so it shifts this way. So I can grasp right away that pushing this button on the mouse with my finger shifted the slide. It isn't that I have to, if you say, well, how do I know that? It's just something I can get right away. Sometimes if you say, what's the cause of something, what explains something, it doesn't require a lot of searching around to find. I just grasp right away what's going on. But on the other hand, this isn't by no means always true. Sometimes it's very difficult to find out what the cause of something is. For example, supposing I wanted a detailed account of what goes on between my pressing on the mouse and the slide shifting, there are all sorts of complicated things that take place in the my computer that I haven't the remotest idea about that bring about the slide moving. So you have to know a great deal to discover these. But the point that we need to bear in mind here that Joyce once insists on is that sometimes we don't need to know a whole lot to find out how we know that something causes something else. Sometimes we can grasp it immediately. Why is that so important? You might say, well, most cases, if we want to know the cause of something, or at least in many cases, we don't grasp it immediately, so why is it so important to say that there are some cases where we do? Well, it's that what we're trying to do is explain, again, how we get from experience of particular events, particular times, to generalization. So if there are some cases where we can grasp immediately what causes something else, this gives us a foot in the door. At least we know that it's possible to come up with true generalizations, at least in these cases. So this at least gives us some reason to think a more general theory is possible. We're not completely at sea. We can't say, well, I have no idea of anything what causes anything else. All we have is just particular experience. If you set that, Joyce could say, well, no, that's wrong, because sometimes you do know that something is causing something else just by pushing the, by putting my finger on the mouse button will shift the slide. So what we, so we know there are some cases where we can't, we do know what it caused, what causes something else, but to understand what's going on and to get a more general theory of cause, we have to investigate the notion of cause. It's that one thing causes or explains something else, but what exactly is meant by cause? What are we talking about when we say something causes something else? Now, Joyce takes an Aristotelian approach to causality. In the Aristotelian scholastic view, there are four types of cause, which are called final, formal, material, and efficient. And this is different from the way cause is taken in modern philosophy. By modern philosophy, we mean philosophy since Descartes in the 17th century. In modern philosophy, we just mean by cause, an efficient cause, meaning something like an event that precedes another event and the other event will invariably follow. That would be one way of saying what cause is. But the view that Joyce and following Aristotle has is much more complicated, much more involved. Now, we'll go through these four causes so you can get an idea of what this Aristotelian view is. Now, the final cause, that final, you say the final means not something like last, but it means from end in the sense of purpose. You know, the end doesn't mean, it doesn't have to mean the, like the end of the story, but it would mean the purpose, what it's for. So the final cause of something is what the thing is for. And in the Aristotelian view, purposes aren't confined to human action. Again, to go back to Mises, those of you who know of human action, Mises makes a very strong distinction. He says, well, there are two ways of investigating phenomena. In the natural world, we could just be kind of observe, say, certain physical particles. We see certain types of particles will move if others move first. We can investigate, kind of look and see what happens. We'll see. We can get laws based on observation. One thing will lead to something else. But according to me, the purposes don't apply in the natural world. We couldn't say something like, what is the purpose that the Earth goes around the sun, because the Earth doesn't have a mind, it doesn't have any goal in mind in going around the sun. It's just following certain physical laws. But in the Aristotelian view, we wouldn't say that. We would say that the Earth does have a purpose in going around the sun. And we wouldn't, in saying that, mean that they imply that the Earth has a mind. You wouldn't be saying Mises is wrong to think that human beings have minds but not physical objects and non-human objects or non-animal objects. Mises isn't wrong about that. But according to Aristotle, everything has a natural end or purpose. Say if you give an example, say the purpose of the heart is to pump blood. And what do we mean by that? It's if you were trying to explain how the heart is moving, why it's thumping and what's going on, you'd say these movements are explained, their function is to pump blood through the body. That's their organized to achieve that purpose. That isn't to say that the heart has a mind, or that there's a conscious mind that designed the heart, although that isn't excluded. It's just we can understand what the heart is doing by realizing that it has that, it has a purpose that explains its actions. So we would say, you could say the purpose of what the earth is doing is revolving around the earth. So what its purpose is to go, what it explains its motion is that the motion has it to go around the earth. That is the goal of the motion. So again, it isn't saying that the earth has a mind, but it's saying you can understand what the earth is doing by seeing that it's constructed so it'll go around the earth in this particular way. And I see there's a comment. She says the goal logic is hidden in modern science. For example, the purpose of plate moving is a means for the earth to use internal heat. Yeah, that's a very good point. You find that in many, like you find that in biology a lot, I think. But what people who support and oppose the Aristotelian view would say is, sure, you can say that, but you can always cash out that language in language that doesn't involve any appeal to purpose. And the Aristotelian view would be, no, you can't. You need to bring in these final causes in order to understand what's going on. Now, the formal cause is something like the shape of something, the principle of organization of a thing. Joyce gives the example of the shape of a statue, sort of a statue, say, consists of stone or marble, and how is it organized? If that would be the shape of the statue, that gives you the form, and sometimes the form isn't literally a shape, say, in Aristotle's view. The soul or mind is the form of the body in the sense that, in his view, the mind is what's organizing the body, what's shaping the body to perform certain motions. And the goal of those motions would be the final cause, but the formal cause is what's organizing the body to achieve that final cause. And the material cause is what is being shaped or formed. It's what something is made of. So, for example, the material cause of a marble statue would be the marble that makes up the statue. Now, I think David said, I just think, he thought all moving bodies had soul. The heavenly bodies were considered alive. Yes, but remember, by soul, he means kind of a principle of organization. He doesn't think that all moving bodies are conscious in the same way human beings are, except they have a principle of organization in them. So as I say, the material cause of a statue would be what it's composed of, say, composed of marble, that's the material cause, and the formal cause would be the shape. There are complications we could bring up, like there would be, you took marble, that would be a formal, marble or would be a formal cause of various things the marble consisted of, and we would have different levels of formal material cause. We don't need to go into that right now, but it just basically, all you need to remember is material cause is what something is made of, formal cause is the shape of something, what's forming the thing, what organizes it. Now the formal and material causes of kind of the shape and material are called intrinsic causes. And why they call that is because they make no reference to anything outside the thing whose causes they are. They look at the statue, except the formal cause is the shape, the material cause is what it's made of, say the marble or stone. So I haven't referred to anything else. I haven't said anything about a sculpture or what goal of the sculpture is, the producing the statue, all I've done is refer just to the thing itself, just to the statue, just at what its shape is and what it's made of. So that's an intrinsic cause. Now, the efficient cause is the closest to the modern conception of cause, the way cause is used in modern science. And the efficient cause is what brings about the change. So in the example of changing the slides, remember I just clicked on the mouse, the slide moved, click on it again. Yeah, I like this. This is a lot of fun, clicking on slides. One of the main point, my most enjoyable parts of my lecture is changing the slides. You know, may not be much, but I have to go for it. I mean, at least it's something to, I have to do something to make this fun. So why not shift line? So in this the example of changing the slides, I'm the efficient cause in this collapse because I brought about the change from one slide to the next. So you notice in this glass view, the efficient cause of the substance is a thing, like a person, in this case myself. It's not an event. And this contrasts with the views of most modern philosophers. So the way most modern philosophers would analyze this, what happened, would be, they'd say something like, the event of my pressing the mouse button caused another event, namely the slide, to move. In the scholastic view, we say, I caused the slide to move. So an efficient cause would be a substance, in this case a person, not an event. And just like, remember we said, formal and material causes are intrinsic because you need to you don't need to refer to anything outside the object you're concerned with. If you have a statue, all you need to know the formal material cause, you just need to look at what the statue's made of and what its shape is. So you get material cause is what it's made of, formal cause is its shape. But for efficient cause, you're introducing something outside the thing. In the case of slides, I'm not identical with the slide. I'm not a slide. I'm something, a substance outside the screen, the slide is bringing about a change in them. And also, so that's called an extrinsic cause. And the final cause makes reference to a purpose of the thing, like the purpose of a heart is to pump blood. Well, the purpose is also outside the heart. It's pumping blood through the body. That's the purpose of it. So, efficient and final cause are called extrinsic causes, and formal and material causes are intrinsic causes. Okay, so this is just what I went over this slide again, so you don't need to go over it. It's again, the final and efficient causes are called extrinsic because they refer to what's outside the object. The final cause is the end or aim of the object. For the efficient cause of substance, it brings about a change in the object. So remember, again, efficient cause is a substance, not an event. And efficient and final causes are extrinsic. They're outside the object. Formal, material, or intrinsic. They're inside the object. You don't need to refer to anything else. So, now we know something about when we say what is, say, we're trying to find out what's the cause of something. We know what to look for, at least if we're following Joyce, because depending on the situation, it can be any one of the four causes. We want to know the cause of something. We'll at least we have the concepts now to investigate the question according to the Aristotelian view that Joyce has set forward. But does this help? How does this help us solve the problem of induction? Supposing we apply this whole apparatus of final, formal, efficient, material causes, and we can say this is the cause of spinal cord, the heart is to pump blood through the body. That's what the heart is for. Will it enable us to come up with universal causal generalization? Suppose somebody says, oh, well, look, okay, the final cause of this heart, that heart, and this other heart are to pump blood through the body. How do we know that's the final cause or purpose of all hearts? Maybe it's just, we've just got a sample or a few where that's true. Maybe we can find a heart that doesn't have that final cause. So how does joy solve the problem just by bringing in this kind of elaborate classification of causes? I see somebody, as Alan has a comment here, Sister Miriam Joseph, the final has caused two parts, the intention and the execution. Yes, that's an interesting distinction. So here, now Aristotle would be taking the final cause more in the sense of what's there, in maybe more closer to what she means by execution, what's actually there in the object, to be able to see what its purpose is. The cause in the sense of mental intention would just come involved in certain cases where there's somebody consciously bringing about something. But remember, in the Aristotelian view, there are final causes and things that haven't been designed or planned. As long as they have regular motion, that's what's the purpose of that motion. So what Joyce says, and here is where he's very close to the view that Leonard Peacock advances in this book by David Harriman that I mentioned earlier. When you arrive at a cause of something, you can abstract from the particular details the instance that you're considering. For example, in the case I gave of changing the slides, I can abstract from saying that clicking the mouse this time caused this slide to move. I can say clicking the mouse will cause the slide to move without referring to a particular occasion. So what I'm doing is I clicked a few times and then I get the general proposition, clicking the mouse. My clicking the mouse will cause the slide to move. So Joyce is saying we can abstract from particular instances and come up with a generalization. But this doesn't really solve the problem. Remember, the problem is how do we get valid causal generalization from particular experience. Now, can someone tell me why doesn't that solve the problem? Suppose you say, well, the reason we can come up with these valid causal generalizations, we can abstract from particulars. We can say it's not just this one instance, we can get a general statement, something will always cause something else. So what's the problem with that? This is something that I think Peacock doesn't see. Now Alan says this is very good, we can't be certain the uniform in nature. Yes, see, we haven't really yet solved the problem of induction, because what we're doing when we say, well, we abstract, is we're assuming that this relationship that we found in particular will always hold. But how do we know that? Sure, we can come up with a generalization, we can abstract from particulars, but how do we know that when we come up with the abstraction that our statement is true? I think if you look at the book by Peacock, you see they don't really understand Peacock and Harriman, don't really understand what the difficulty is. They just take laws of nature to be abstraction. They think, well, we're making the abstraction properly, so it's all right. But it's important to see, you make the abstraction, it still leaves open the question what justifies you in concluding the abstraction rule that you come up with always holds. Now, Joyce appeals here to the principle of uniformity of nature, which is the same cause will, under the same circumstance, produce the same effect. And he said this is a metaphysical principle, kind of general principle of philosophy that applies to the physical world. So if you say, how do you know what justifies you in making these general stations from experience? He said, well, you're appealing to the principle of the uniformity of nature. Now, one thing, this next slide, this is a bit of a rather fine point, so if you don't get this one, don't worry about it, but I thought it's interesting to put in. So according to Joyce, when you're appealing to this principle of uniformity of nature, basically the principle of same cause, same effect, this is not the way you're reasoning. You say nature is uniform on various occasions, like clicking the mouse causes flight to move, so I conclude clicking the mouse and right certain things will always cause the flight to move. Joyce said that isn't the right way to think about it. Well, I see that Keith, who's the geology expert, said there was a long-running controversy in geology between catastrophes and uniformitarians. Well, that's a very interesting point. That let me get to that right after I go get this slide. Why does Joyce say we don't want to bring in uniformity of nature as a separate premise? And again, remember, this is kind of a subtle point, so don't worry if you don't get it right. If Joyce says, once I say clicking the mouse causes the slide to move, then I've already appealed to uniformity. Because when I say it's the nature of clicking the mouse in the appropriate circumstances, the result of the slide will move, I'm already relying on uniformity, so I don't need to bring it in. Let's look at the case again. I said, my clicking the mouse causes a slide to move, so there, according to Joyce, I'm already appealing to uniformity. So I don't need to bring uniformity of nature in as a separate principle. It's just that that explains what's involved, that justifies, if that principle is true, that justifies the whole invocation of the notion of cause. Cause depends on the truth of uniformity of nature. Now, Keith had mentioned the controversy between uniformitarianism and catastrophism in geology. Now, they're using uniformity of nature in a somewhat different way. That's basically in geology. The controversy is like, are there the changes in the Earth's surface come up slowly, say by gradual building up of sediments, they get enough sediment build up, you'll eventually get a mountain, or the catastrophic big events that cause changing the structure of the Earth. We see both of those things would be appealing to uniformity of nature in the sense we're referring here. It isn't a matter, in this sense, it doesn't matter how fast or how big changes are, but the principle we're interested in is, will the same causes always produce the same event? So both parties in this geological controversy would be appealing to uniformity of nature. They just have different views on how nature works in particular circumstances. I haven't given you, as you've no doubt noticed, what a solution to the problem induction is. I just mentioned that induction, according to Joyce, depends on the principle of uniformity of nature, but we haven't really justified the principle of uniformity of nature. So what Joyce has done, really, is just clarify what's involved in the claim that induction is valid, or induction gives you true generalizations of experience. He hasn't really shown that this is correct, but he's just clarifying what's involved in the claim. Now, I want to say now something. by a different kind of use of the term induction, different from ordinary induction. And this is what's called an inductive syllogism. And this doesn't get us involved in Kant's justifying induction. I've been talking about it. I think this is the question. Chris said, if you're relying on it, you don't bring it in the major premise, wouldn't you be begging the question? No, because what you have in the premise is just one thing causes something else. So you wouldn't be begging the question unless what you were trying to establish, if the principle of uniformity of nature were true. But here, you're assuming the principle is true, and then you're getting further conclusions from it. So you're not begging the question in the conclusion of your syllogism isn't one of the premises. Suppose you're trying to establish that, let's look at this case again here. Suppose I'm trying to go from, on various occasions, my clicking mouse causes the slide to move here, and I conclude clicking mouse, right, so will always cause the slide to move. Here, I'm just unpacking what's involved in the notion of a cause. I'm not trying to deduce that, conclude from it, prove that nature is uniform. I'm just unpacking what's involved in the notion of cause. I'm not, for begging the question, you have to have the same, the conclusion has to be the same as one of the premises, and it isn't here. Okay, so inductive syllogism, we say something applies to all the logical parts of a whole, it's true of the whole. Sometimes this is used in geometry, for example. Suppose you said something like you want to prove a certain proposition about triangles. So you say, well, there are three kinds of triangles, and this proposition is true of this kind of triangle, that kind of triangle, the third kind of triangle. So then it's true of all of them. So that would be valid because you said there are three kinds of triangles, those are the only two kinds, and this proposition is true of all of them, so then it's true of the whole. But if you do that, inductive syllogism, it doesn't establish connection between the nature of the whole subject and the property attributed to it. It doesn't say, in example like it doesn't say, it's part of the nature of a triangle that this proposition applies to. What you've done is say, triangle has, there's so many, say, three different types of triangle, and the proposition applies to each of them, so then it applies to the whole thing. But it could be there's a different sort of connection for each kind of triangle with the proposition. So you haven't established a logical connection between the nature of triangles and this proposition. You just said proposition is related to this. This connection to the proposition, each kind of triangle, and that's all the kinds of triangles there are, so the proposition applies to all triangles. Now, there's another type of induction we haven't talked about yet called imperfect induction. This is sometimes called enumerative induction. And in this type, you enumerate or list all the instances in a certain whole that possess a certain property, and then you conclude that every instance has the property. So you notice the difference from the inductive syllogism, which I just explained, which is about subtypes of a whole, not instances. In the example I gave, I said, well, all right, imagine that we can show there are three kinds of triangles. And then we say a certain proposition we can show applies to each one of them. So then we know that proposition is true of all triangles given that there are only three kinds and applies to each of them. Now, in perfect or enumerative induction, I would just say, well, I'm just considering particular triangles, not kinds of triangles. this is true of this triangle, this is true of that triangle, this is true of third triangle. Therefore, I conclude it's true of all triangles just because I'm list going through various triangles, and then it would be correct. Now, supposing I listed every instance in a particular class and said a certain thing is true of every instance, then it would be called a perfect induction, and it's now it's called perfect because it's completed. Suppose, for example, I ask each student in this class, are you interested in logic? And each person says yes, then I can conclude that everyone is interested in logic because I've gone through every person in the class, every person said he's interested in logic, so then that's a perfect induction. But if I generalize from a few instances, the induction is imperfect and it isn't worth much. I mean, supposing I asked a few people, are you interested in logic? Say, three of you said yes. I wouldn't have good grounds for saying everybody in the class is interested in logic. Maybe I just got a sample. I just happened to ask a few people who are interested, but it turns out there are a lot of people in the class who aren't interested in logic. So it wouldn't be very good reasoning there. Now, so you see now enumerative induction seems different from the kind Joyce was talking about. But Joyce is concerned with trying to find a cause of something and then getting a generalization. We're abstracting from particular instances. We're coming up with a general causal relationship, but what we do in enumerative induction, we're not coming up with cause, we're just listing particular events. For example, taking, suppose we have, say, when we're considering, are all swans white? Well, we just take this swan is white, this one is white, this one is white. So enumerative imperfect induction would be saying all swans are white based on a certain sample of. Now, the scholastic account that I just mentioned by Joyce wouldn't be accepted by most modern philosophers who work on induction. Remember, because Joyce is appealing to the principle of uniformity of nature, or same cause, same effect. So most, or at least a lot of modern philosophers, have been influenced by a famous argument given by the great 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. Now, Hume said, we do rely on this principle of uniformity of nature, but it's not something we could establish by reason. We could say people are rational to accept uniformity of nature. It's just a habit that we have. We happen to have this principle that we follow. And it isn't that induction is particularly reasonable or unreasonable. It's just people do, in fact, their minds operate in that way. It's just a matter of habit. And Hume had a very interesting argument. Suppose I said, maybe you could show that there's some argument to establish the uniformity of nature. Hume said, how would you establish such a principle? He said, you'd either have to have it by reason, you'd have to have some kind of logical argument that would establish the principle of same cause, same effect. Or you could appeal to experience. And Hume thought neither one of those would work. He said, it isn't contradictory to deny uniformity. Suppose you said that there can be cases where you apply exactly the same cause, but you get completely different effects. He said, that doesn't violate any logical laws. It isn't a contradiction to say that. Remember, I think we mentioned in earlier lectures, some of the objectors say that is a contradiction. I think Hume is right. It isn't part of a concept of a cause that it has to have the same effect. Or if we said it was, then we would say, how would we really know something that the cause of it? We really wouldn't have established anything. Then, so we say, well, it's not contradictory to deny it, but then suppose we say it's supported by experience. So we say experience supports it because the same causes have been observed to have the same effects in the past. So we say, well, whenever I've seen water, it's always flowing downhill, so I can be justifying thinking there's a universal principle that water always flows downhill. But Hume says, well, how would you justify such an image? How would you justify going from it's always happened in the past, it will continue to happen in the future? You'd be justifying this only if you're already assuming uniformity of nature. So in this would be a case where Christopher's question would apply exactly like Hume would say. Here you would be using, if you said experience supports uniformity of nature, you would be using appealing to uniformity of nature to support uniformity of nature, appealing to that support at the very conclusion. So that would be begging the question. You say, well, I expect the future to be like the past because I expect things to be continuing the way they have in the past, in the future, and I do this because of all the times it's happened. I expect this because of all the times it's happened in the whatever it is that's happened in the past. If you conclude that, well, it's happened this way in the past, therefore it will happen in the future, you're already appealing to uniformity of nature, so you can't say, well, it's dependent on the you're begging the question. So he says, well, you can't establish uniform nature by appeal to reason or experience, so you can't really establish it. Now, the very influential 20th century philosopher of science, Karl Popper, accepts Hume's argument, says that we can't justify uniform nature, and we need that to justify induction. So Popper's response had a very radical one. He says, we don't need induction. We don't need to say from the fact that a number of instances of a causal relation have been observed, we're justifying inferring the causal law. All we need to do is to say, well, we have a certain hypothesis, and we can see whether it can be falsified. We don't need anything more. Say we say, well, we just say water always runs downhill. I don't need to establish that according to Popper by some kind of appeal to me for an age. I just say, that's my hypothesis, and then I can see, will somebody be able to refute it? And if it isn't, then if so far, I can keep it because it hasn't been refuted. So, on Popper's view, we can say that a theory hasn't yet been falsified, but this gives us no grounds to expect it will continue to be true in the future. So a lot of people, in my view, surprisingly, some people at least who frequent the Mises community blog are attracted to this, but it seems, I think we should be very careful before endorsing this view. It's a very skeptical view. For example, on Popper, we'd have to say, we don't know that stepping in front of a speeding car will have bad consequences for you if you do it. We know that that hypothesis hasn't yet been falsified. But on Popper's view, we don't have any grounds for thinking it's true. It's just we haven't come up with a counterexample to it. But we don't think that the view that you wouldn't have any inductive support. So now I wanted to mention this is something a student just give an example of a fallacy. We were talking, of course, about fallacies. Someone sent in a case where someone has written in kind of a peculiar post. You realize that anything which applies to government also applies to God. The government is the one earthly entity that closest resembles God, kind of a bit illiterate. If obeying to the government, if blind faith and blind obedience when the government is wrong, same thing goes for God. So this person's saying, well, if you question obeying the government, you're really questioning obeying God because the government is like God. It Christopher Langinelli, this example of begging the question. Let me see it's not strictly a case of begging the question, because the argument doesn't start with the premise that not obeying the state is like not obeying God, then conclude to the same proposition. Remember, begging questions are starting with a certain proposition that in the premise, then coming up with the same conclusion in the same thing with the conclusion. So your premise and conclusion are identical. But what's involved here is that you're assuming a controversial question. The state is like God, probably only those who reject disobedience of the state are likely to accept that. So the argument really wouldn't be worth very much, because no one who doesn't already accept the conclusion will grant you the premise. So it's very much a live begging question. Now, Christopher points out, it's also assuming God demands obedience, yet that is an additional assumption, but maybe that's less controversial than the one that the state is like God. Because the way most people conceive of God, I guess he does demand obedience. People could deny that. I mean, people have a deist view of God, which God doesn't make any demands on human beings. But you're quite right, that is an additional premise. Somebody wanted to know on this, sent in a question on this argument, does it have an undistributed middle term? I didn't think it did. So it's enough wrong with it already, having just this appeal to a controversial premise. You've already got something wrong. Fauci is also saying, someone said, you see the word obedience appear a lot in the Bible, and you see Christians use the word obedience a lot. The last time a charismatic person used the word obey and obedience as often as the Christians do, the Second World War erupted. I say, let's get rid of both the government, the Christianity, and all other religions for all I care. Again, not one of the great reasoners. Now, this argument commits a post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. After this, therefore, because of it. So, what this person was saying, they expect one can get a coherent train of propositions up from the quotation, is the last time a charismatic person used the words obey and obedience as often as the Christian do, the Second World War erupted. And it wouldn't follow just because the war came after the use of obedience, it doesn't follow that using this word caused the war. So you can see kind of an obvious fallacy there. So I think that was the last slide. So in the time remaining, we have some questions here. I guess I'll go to the Q&A, but you can also put something in the chat if you want. Also, now Keith said, I don't believe in government. I don't agree with it. Yes, I think that's certainly a good distinction to make. I'm not exactly how it comes into the argument. Maybe you could explain that a bit more, but I think you can certainly say you don't agree with the government, and that many people don't. So, okay, I've gone to the Q&A, and I'm also on the chat, so you can type in whatever you like. Anyone have any questions, comments, refutations? David said, I still don't have a good feel for what betting the question is. Okay, that's a very good question. Let's go over that. Well, let's take an argument. Suppose we said something like this. What would be a good case? Let me just come up with a case here. Suppose you said something like, I'm trying to construct a good case for you. Suppose you said you should always obey the government because the government is worthy of obedience. So here, you say the government is worthy of obedience. You're just saying the same thing as you should always obey the government. You see, you wouldn't be giving a reason for saying you should always obey the government. You'd just be restating the claim. You'd just be saying the same thing over again. We have there's a Latin phrase, idem per idem, the same thing over. So in begging the question, you're really saying the same thing over again. Now, here's a kind of a philosophical example my friend Father Sadowski gave me a few days ago. Suppose someone said, we can't know the future because the future doesn't exist. So here, what would be meant by saying that you can't know the future because it doesn't exist, you wouldn't be really giving a reason that you can't know the future. Just to say it doesn't exist is just really to say over again, you can't know it. You see, just be repeating the same thing. So David says, obeying the question is somewhat like a tautology. Yes, that is. That's a very good way of putting it. It's something like you're repeating the same thing in the conclusion and in the premise. Now, they more extended sense of begging the question, where it doesn't have to be exactly the same thing in the conclusion as is in one of the premises, but just more extended sense, you wouldn't accept the conclusion unless you already accepted the premise. For example, suppose somebody said, you should support Mitt Romney for president because he's likely to be the Republican nominee, and you should also always support the Republican nominee. Well, suppose somebody gave this as a reason for supporting Mitt Romney. Well, you wouldn't accept that unless you already accepted the view that you would always support the Republican nominee. That wouldn't be persuasive to anybody other than someone who was already inclined to support Mitt Romney. So you wouldn't be getting very far with the argument. A good argument, you're trying to appeal to some principle of the person. You want your conclusion to be something that really isn't so obvious from the premise that somebody who would accept the premise wouldn't already be committed to the conclusion. So then if you get him to accept the conclusion, if he wanted to reject the conclusion, you have to reject the premise he already accepted. So basically, begging the question is the same conclusion as in the premise or something in the extent that is very close to the something in the premise. Now, Christopher says, wait, I can't do. you're laying claim to the principle, yet this seems to be the fallacy of equivocation. Wrapping your comment by Alan. The last term represents an interesting use of the words obeying obedience, and they are assumed to be the response to coercion. Yet I obey my instincts about the right thing, you resemble, even though I don't fear me. That's an interesting point. I guess somebody could just reply to that by saying obedience is a more general notion, including both doing things like following what you think to be right and also responding to coercion. So somebody could say, well, there's a more general concept of obedience. And the person might also reply, say, to accept your decision and say, okay, well, we do have this notion of obedience as a response to coercion, but the person could say, well, the appropriate attitude toward the government isn't that we should just do what the government says because we're afraid they'll use violence on us if we don't. Rather, just as we ought to do what God tells us we ought to do what the government says. Somebody could say you're right to make that decision, but the sense of obedience and doing what we ought applies to the government. Of course, I wouldn't adopt that line, but I mean, someone who favored that view could. So I think you could get out of your objection that way. So I don't think it could be equivocation to use different concepts of obedience, but you wouldn't have to be, you see. Now, Key says, much too kindly for me now. If I start a thread in the forum, could you please give reference to different views on uniformity? I've got some refs, but I haven't the background in philosophy to make much sense of them. For example, J.S. Mill, like Thomas Brown's idea that Schopenhauer claimed Kant cleared it all up before him. Yes, well, if you look in the Joyce, you should read Joyce's chapter on uniformity of nature. I didn't assign that as part of the reading, but he gives quite a good discussion of different views on uniformity of nature, what people have to say about it. So that would be one I'd recommend to read the chapter in Joyce. That's a good background. Now, Schopenhauer now wrote on the fourfold root of the principle of sufficient reason, where he discusses the whole notion of causation also. You're quite right to bring him up. You know what Schopenhauer's mother said when he had this dissertation of fourfold root of the principle of sufficient reason? She said, oh, this sounds like something you get from a pharmacy. He didn't get along well with his mother. And he thought she was admit she very often made sarcastic remarks about him, and that was one of them. Okay, well, we have another. Philip says, please explain the relationship of scholastic logic to praxeology. Well, that's an interesting question. You see, praxeology is deductive, and in the way that Mises and Rothbard carried on, it's in ordinary language. It isn't you're making the deductions in symbolic or mathematical logic. So you're using ordinary language logic in your reasoning. And the system I've been teaching, the one by Joyce, is an example of ordinary logic reasoning. Scholastic logic uses ordinary language. So this is a particular way of understanding ordinary language reasoning. So you wouldn't, I mean, somebody could reject scholastic logic and use some other kind of logical system and use that in praxeology. But I'd say scholastic logic is a good way of helping, of understanding praxeological reason, but you wouldn't be committed to scholastic law and find praxeology. I think Rothbard would be someone who uses scholastic logic, and he's very familiar with various textbooks in scholastic philosophy. Mises tended to be not as sympathetic to scholasticism, to say the least, philosophy, but I think in his use of reasoning, he's certainly in accord with scholastic logic, even though he doesn't make explicit reference to it. Now, here, there's a question from Jill. Doing the right thing, doing the right thing brings wholesome effect, doing the wrong thing brings unwholesome effect. The person prefers wholesome effect over unwholesome effect, where the concept of obedience even apply. Not if you thought that you could define wholesome and unwholesome effects apart from orders from the state or from God, but someone who defended such a view might say it's part of the concept of a wholesome effect that it obeys the proper authority. So the person who defended that view, again, I'm not one who does, but I think could get out of your point in that way by just building into the notion wholesome and unwholesome effect obedience to proper authority. All right, Christopher says, depends on if obedience makes one unwholesome. Yes, oh good, Christopher, you had the same point I was made. I didn't see your point. You're quite right. I mean, that was exactly how I thought that should be handled. Good. At least we're in this together. Good. Chris, he said, when is the last quiz you invite? That would be up to Danny. And the question, how long will we have access to your lecture? I think as long as you like, they're up there indefinitely, you know, so you can always refer to them. Yeah, the password is as long as you get into the Reader Academy. Yeah, you can download them if you want. How long will the discussion forum remain active? Well, I mean, I'll check back, you know, as long as people send in questions, I'll try to answer them. And you're looking forward to Phil, too. Well, I could give such a course sometime. I mean, I've given, this is the second time I've given Phil one, so I'd have to learn a little bit more logic before I could do that, but maybe I can do that. That's pretty kind of you to ask. And I remember I have another course, and I have a course now that I'm going to be giving. I'm giving a course now on the old right and the National New Conservatives and the neoconservatives. That's a kind of intellectual history course. And if anyone wants to enroll in that, we need more students in that. And I'm also planning courses coming up soon will be on the second volume of Rothbard's History of Economic Thought. And then I have two others will be that coming up April 24th. And I have two others coming up on history of political philosophy and on Marxism. And Christopher wants to know when's the next objective in class one, if that would be up to Danny. I mean, but you know, possibly if there's enough interest in that, one could do that. But, you know, we'll just have to see. But people can enroll in this, the Trail of American Right, it would be very good because we need more students in that. the more students, the better, especially for me. Oh, Cam likes my class. Well, thank you. Thank you, Cam. It's kind of you to say that. We have some good students in it. Well, thank you. I'm glad you like the course. It was oh, good. Well, I have some fans here. That's much appreciated. We have a few more minutes for questions. If anybody has anything else? Now, Philip says, how about a course on music theory and history? Well, I did give a course on Mises epistemology where we covered theory and history, but it would be nice to give a course just on theory, history, on philosophy of history. That's a very good idea. I'll have to look into that. Of course, one I'd like to do they wouldn't let me do is history professional wrestling. Oh, Cam, that's good. Are you a wrestling fan? Oh, that's very good. Oh, I'm glad. I used to know Lou Fez. Who were some of the wrestlers in that WCW? Jeff says, why isn't meeting more widely read? How this stuff is so good, I don't understand. Can you enlighten me? Well, I think, see, of course, Mises' views aren't in tune with the kind of dominant trends in modern universities, which tend to favor pretty much state power and a mixed economy. So I think Mises really shows what's wrong with those views. I don't think people like having their views shown up. I remember I was reading the Post once by Brad DeLong, who's an economic historian, economist at Berkeley, he had been reading Mises' theory of money and credit. He said, well, Mises is insane. You know, he's giving his view that we don't need a gold standard, we don't need the government control of money. He said, well, this is just insane. So I think Mises' views are very much out of favor. So I think I think more people are aware of it than before. But, you know, I think there's a lot of opposition to his thinking. Now, he said he wasn't in pre-World War I. Yes, he was always out of fashion, although he was very influential at one time in Europe, but he was always an intransigent person, someone who didn't compromise. He could see things very clearly and he would say what he thought was true. And that got him into that. Unfortunately, many intellectuals don't do that. They just say what they think will advance the power of the state or what will get them good positions or earn money for them. Oh, Ric Flair, yeah. Oh, yeah, Bill Goldberg, yeah. Yeah, I remember, Goldberg used to have that funny hold for the spear or something. Yeah, he was a good one. Yeah, Ric Flair had the figure four grapevine with that. Of course, Buddy Rogers earlier was the one who used that. But see, I go back to a somewhat earlier period of Lou Fez, Freddie Glassie. Yeah, these were the great. Oh, good, yeah. Lou Fez I used to call up. I spoke to Glassie, but just very briefly once. Glassie was one of the great fighters. Well, that doesn't have much to do with scholastic logic, but it's fun. And, okay, well, I guess we're out of time now, so I want to thank everybody for, yeah, Classy Freddy Blasty. He was, we would always call people Pencil Neck Geek. You're listening to Pencil Neck Geek, Freddy Blasty coming into the room. Okay, well, thanks for coming to my class. I hope to see you in future work. Thank you, everybody. So, hope to see a lot of you this coming Wednesday when I give my Betrayal of the American Right course. We'd like to get the enrollment up. There's still plenty of time to get in. Okay, Jeff, I see you enrolled for quite a lot of my classes. I appreciate that. I note this down. Thank you. Okay, thanks, everybody. See you. Well, thank you, Jeff.
Oh, hi, Naomi. It was like I finished my lecture now. Yeah. Oh, okay. I see this a... Oh, okay. Okay, so you'll let me know when you'll be able to come. Oh, okay. Thanks, Lord. Okay. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.